Thank you, Stan. With reference to the time problem that we have here today, I'll try to do what Stan and I have both had to do from time to time. Speaking for television, you're supposed to speed up what you do so that instead of speaking at a normal conversational speed, you try to be a little bit more like a machine gun, and I'm told it sounds much better over television. I'm not so sure whether that's the way to do it here, but if we're going to try to compress everything into a relatively shorter period of time, I think it's probably a good idea. So let me turn to the media and their power, with all apologies to those who have said that we've spoken in this session about power. I think, unfortunately, it will be power again. It's not so much that they have the authority, but they certainly do have the power. Well, there aren't even too many people in the national media who will deny the great power that they wield. A magazine solicitation for the Columbia Journalism Review makes no bones. Let me quote it so it's not coming from a malevolent, Agnew-esque source. Today's news media in America wield power that staggers the imagination. With fully 75% of our population now living in urban areas, a relatively few metropolitan newspapers reach and influence millions of Americans each day. Television and radio newscasters, using the powerful immediacy of their media, can and do introduce new heroes and villains overnight to vast numbers of people. We all know who the villains they introduced overnight to vast number of people are, or the villainy that they described so effectively. Perhaps the heroes are yet to emerge, unless it's Jimmy Carter, but I doubt that. But the real question to address here is, what has the impact of the media been on the system, and how is the power that they have gathered and will gather coming home to roost in terms of the efficacy of the American system and the ways in which the other components, executive, legislative, and judicial, are able to function? Now, an awful lot of people on the liberal side will say that this is an old, old debate. And they'll talk about the idea of the press being a fourth branch of government going back to the French Revolutionary era, which it does. And they'll say that all of our great presidents, Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, and Roosevelt, tangled with the press, and their supporters made frequent reference to its power and ability to set the agenda of national debate. So I think the central question, if today's argument about media power is to be differentiated from the arguments of the 1790s and the 1860s and the 1930s, what new factors achieve that differentiation? And in this paper, I intend to elaborate the thesis that America has undergone a post-industrial or communications revolution that has elevated the major media to an economic size, technological sophistication, and cultural importance totally unmatched in the day of Edmund Burke, who discussed the power of the press, or even the day of Robert A. Taft. Increasingly, we live in a polity and a society that can be described as a mediocrity, where communications mechanisms and knowledge industry, elites and executives play a dominant role that land ownership and land elites played in the aristocratic and agricultural eras, and that manufacturing and capitalist elites and rising middle class values played in the era of Western democracy and parliamentary supremacy beginning in the 19th century. Now, if you accept the notion of media power having reached a new magnitude and importance because of the post-industrial revolution, which is a central point, a lot of other things follow. So let's go back and try to look at whether they have in fact reached a new magnitude and a new dimension of impact. In 1790, when Edmund Burke and others were talking about the press as a fourth branch of government, what indeed was it? Newspapers alone, with a circulation of a few thousand in countries with populations of 5 or 10 million, no more than that. The communications industry, the production, consumption, and dissemination of knowledge, might have accounted at best for a few percentage points of the gross national product. Even a century later, when manufacturing had displaced agriculture as the mainstay of economic life in both Britain and the United States, the knowledge and communications industries were small potatoes, totaling no more than a few percentage points of the GNP. But all this began to change in the 1920s and 1930s with the rise of electronic technology. And the other segments of the knowledge industry grew too, especially after World War II. Fast research, swelling bureaucracy, massive education, mushrooming skilled professional ranks, proliferating service workers. As a result, the percentage of the GNP accounted for by the production, consumption, and dissemination of knowledge soared. In 1920, it had been about 12%. By 1950, it was perhaps 20%. By 1960, about 25%. And by the early 1970s, Peter Drucker, Daniel Bell, and others have put it at approximately 35% of the GNP. The knowledge industry, broadly construed, had replaced manufacturing as the critical element of the U.S. economy. Now, quite a few scholars have already described the impact of this upheaval. Daniel Bell has called it the post-industrial revolution. Professor John Kenneth Galbraith, in his book, The New Industrial State, lays the secret of the political change and the change of control of American society right out. He says one should expect from past experience to find a new shift of power in the industrial enterprise, this one from capital to organized intelligence. Organized intelligence is a short description for the knowledge industry. Admittedly overgeneralized, but nevertheless a useful term. Now, what's the impact in terms of class and vocational structures of this knowledge revolution? Professor Irving Kristol and Daniel Bell have written widely, and I'm sure you've seen their analyses in the Wall Street Journal and other places, on the notion of a new class. To Kristol, the rising knowledge industry elite is anti-capitalist and anxious to flex its new muscle. In bygone days, the press used to reflect competing segments of aristocratic or industrial society. Now, at least in the national media, that is less and less true. The major national media represent the interests of the emerging new class, their own class. This is unique. It hasn't happened before. Until the post-industrial revolution, the new class of the knowledge industry was too small to be a power elite in its own right. Needless to say, the process isn't complete. In New York, Boston, Washington, Chicago, and the major cities, the national media do strongly interact with the knowledge industry, with scholars, bureaucrats, foundation executives, interest groups, and friendly politicians. So the major national media, the television networks, Time, Newsweek, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, typically mirror new class values. But not so the television affiliates or small newspapers outside the major population areas. So in this sense, I disagree with Irving Kristol, who says the media are the new class or education is the new class. That's not true. It's not true in Indianapolis. It's not true in Phoenix. It's not true in Dallas. It's certainly not true in Boise. And this is, again, a pattern that we've seen with every change in the form of new economics. Because in the days of William Jennings Bryan, the small town bankers of Idaho and Nebraska and Tennessee were as much against the power structures of Wall Street as many of the small media and small affiliates are against the power of CBS or the New York Times. But for our purposes in considering the power of the media, it's the major national media that set the pace. In a 1974 article, Lewis Lapham, managing editor of Harper's, described the concentration of power in news dissemination. He said, as much as 90% of the news that reaches the American public arrives through the channels of the two wire services, AP and UPI, the three networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, Time, Inc., the Washington Post Syndicate, which of course owns Newsweek, New York Times Syndicate, possibly the Knight and Newhouse newspapers. The managers of these enterprises could quite comfortably sit around a small table in a small room. Thus, the fact that these national media articulate new class values is enormously important. And this new role is a far cry from the old role of the media, which still persists in many smaller towns and cities, of being a spokesman for local agricultural or industrial interests. The national media have become the linchpin of knowledge industry interests and values, and this new role has lured many of the most talented members of the new class. Harvard professor Samuel Beer says that, quote, "The media revolution is as powerful as the industrial revolution was. The word manipulators are on top, and like the 19th century capitalists, everyone considered inferior will wind up running the world." None of this would be true, of course, or possible except for the new technological impact of the media. The same post-industrial revolution that has elevated the knowledge industry to 35% of the U.S. GNP has given the media, essentially the electronic media, but they all interact, an unprecedented ability to reach people and mold national opinion. As the Columbia Journalism Review proclaims, new heroes and villains can be introduced to the American people overnight. At this point, it's useful to switch focus and consider just how the new political impact of the media is different than the old. Let's begin by setting aside superficial remarks about bias and loaded coverage of liberals versus conservatives. That's often true, but I think the real problem is a good bit more complex. First, if we're going to think in terms of a mediocracy, the idea of media power, it's necessary to think in terms that go beyond CBS time and the Washington Post. Use of computerized voter registration lists, central to 1976 GOP New Hampshire primary campaigns and many others, is reliance upon a communications medium. So is use of direct mail for fundraising, so are telephone banks, so is a presidential press conference or a presidential nationwide hookup. And it would be foolish even to forget the increasing importance of rock concerts. The president of General Motors can only give your campaign $1,000, but a rock star can donate his services, hold a concert, pack in 5,000 kids, and raise $50,000, it will get federal matching funds. All of these are ways in which leverage over a political campaign has shifted away from manufacturing and industry to the people who are in the media broadly defined, whether they be direct mail people, whether they be merely technicians who prepare advertising spots, whether they put together a very effective speech like Governor Reagan used, or whether they indeed be the people that control the major media, or whether they be a rock star who puts on a performance that raises $50,000 for George McGovern or somebody. All of this is media politics. And most of what is important in U.S. politics is media-based in this larger view of the words media and medium. So has this changed politics? Sure it has. The old politics used to depend on local machines, on individuals with a lot of money, on powerful industrial-era institutions. And thus it took its values and style from those institutions. Today's politics is changing styles. For example, most of the 1976 Democratic presidential candidates have come out for marijuana decriminalization. Otherwise, few rock stars would help them raise money. I say that privately. Television, of course, has also changed the style of politics. It puts a premium on mediagenic candidates rather than on the machine loyalists of yesterday. And the national media in general put a premium on people who embrace the general progressivism and value structure of the new class. For example, Lyndon Johnson is quoted by David Halberstam in his new book, CBS, The Power and the Profits, as saying this to a CBS producer, quoting Johnson. All you guys in the media, all of the politics changed because of you. You've broken all the machines and the ties between us and Congress and the city machines. You've given us a new type of people, Teddy, Tunney. They're your creations, your puppets. No machine could ever create a Teddy Kennedy. Only you guys, they're all yours, your product. And that's so true. Celebrityhood isn't a new thing in politics, of course, but the nature of celebrityhood is shifting. The old type of celebrity was a general, Zachary Taylor or somebody, a local landholder, a big businessman. Now the celebrities increasingly come from the world of knowledge, artistic performance, and media, broadly construed. The difference is quite real. Let me digress here to point out that the media are also increasingly the source of new fortunes. Agriculture and land yielded to manufacturing in this capacity a century ago, and now the knowledge industry and the media are taking over. To paraphrase Marshall McLuhan, the medium is also the money. Consider, when Pablo Picasso died not long ago, his estate was over $1 billion. Why? Because he had so many of his own paintings. Rock star Elton John will bring in $60 million this year. Peter Benchley, who wrote the book Jaws, will probably make $20 to $30 million from book and movie rights. Books and movies have become a major source of wealth, and even in the field of business and industry, many of the new fortunes come from the knowledge industry. Computer technology, both hardware and software. Communications, various processes and patents. A growing percentage of America's rich have made their money in and are interested in the flow of change, ideas, information, and systems. A media-based politics resting on this kind of establishment simply cannot be conservative in the traditional sense, and the establishment cannot be conservative in the traditional sense. Moreover, a number of scholars have begun to argue that the rise of the media is directly related to the emerging alienation and instability of U.S. society. A media culture wallows in the exciting, the weird, the negative, and the different. That's the nature of the beast. Just think of the institutions that have suffered under the guns of the national media. Business, the military, the neighborhood, the family. As pre-communications revolution institutions, these are arguably less important to the new class than to the average citizen. Irving Kristol and others have sketched the anti-business climate that prevails among the new class and in the media. Ernest Lefevre of the Brookings Institution has documented CBS Television's disinterest in defense preparedness, and the Gannett News Service procured this extraordinary quote from Walter Cronkite about a year ago. Walter Cronkite said, "There are always groups in Washington expressing views of alarm over the state of our defenses. We don't carry those stories. The story is that there are those who want to cut defense spending." In this same vein, Edward J. Epstein contributed a brilliant three-part 1973 series to TV Guide on the role of television in Vietnam. At first, he documents television build up the war. Then by 1967, network leaders changed their minds. At the height of the anti-war protests, NBC News producer Robert Northshield told the New York Times, quote, "TV is directly responsible for 125,000 people showing up at UN Plaza to demonstrate against the war." But the irony was well summed up by Epstein because the media were on both sides of that one. Epstein says, "It's no doubt true that television was to a large extent responsible for the disillusionment with the war, as those in the media take relish in pointing out. But it is also true that television must take the responsibility for creating, or at least reinforcing, the illusion of American military omnipotence on which much of the early support for the war was based. As for neighborhoods, the new class enjoys townhouses in central city redevelopment areas. The importance of neighborhood is marginal, and a lack of any such concern has been writ large in coverage of housing and busing squabbles. Religion is also marginal, and author Michael Novak makes this pithy point about media attitudes towards the family. He says, in our society, corporations, government, and the media have been devastating to family people. Almost everything about jobs, work conditions, government programs, and the images flooding out from the media ignores the need of families, injures families. We desperately need political leaders and social strategists who understand the needs of families today. But considering all these points together, the principal overriding impact of the major media has been to increase instability and alienation in many, many different ways. And one of the most blunt statements of this thesis, and I think a quite well-written one, but it's quite lengthy if you read it, it's been put together by Catholic University political scientist Michael Robinson. In a recent study put out by the Aspen Institute, he had this to say. Television journalism has altered the long-established balance between patriating agencies, segments of society which generally portray our conditions as favorable and preferable, vis-a-vis dispatriating agencies, those which generally portray our conditions as wretched and becoming more so. The networks speak to an audience which contains an enormous pool of politically unskilled individuals, those who rely on eighth grade civics curriculum to comprehend national politics. Their perceptions are not only limited, they are naive. Television's focus is murderous for these people. We may, in fact, be on the verge of a new era of television malaise. And if we weren't there when they wrote that, we're certainly on the road to that when television is showing the Manson movies so that CBS can regain its lead over ABC and all of that sort of thing. It's just trumping. Each time they go somewhere, they go a little further. Now, if you take all of these levels of media analysis, looking at them culturally, economically, as an elite, and their influence on the political party system and on the political process, I think it's much more effective and important than trying to elaborate on computations of minutes or lineage devoted to different candidates in different elections. On the national level, the real critical power of the media does not lie in hypothetical ability to tip an election to presidential candidate X rather than Y. It lies much more in the ability to trumpet an issue, cripple a power center, fan a mood, create a villain, topple two presidents, or scuttle a war. Which brings us to the question of the media as a power center ranking for purposes of this discussion with the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. This is the key. Back in 1974, when the Watergate firestorm was raging most fiercely, the survey of national opinion leaders by U.S. News and World Report found that television was ranked ahead of the White House as the country's number one power center. By 1975, with Richard Nixon out of office, the presidency was ahead again, but television was close behind in second place. By way of background, the big loser in the post-industrial power struggle over the last 15 years has been Congress. During the 1960s, the power centers gaining were clearly the executive, the judiciary, and the media. The legislative branch was losing ground. Superficially, to be sure, the toppling of Richard Nixon changed all of that. The presidency lost ground, Congress gained. But in many ways, the seeming rise of Congress has been a mirror image of the real rise of media power. The Washington Post's Sally Quinn put it best, perhaps, and definitely unintentionally, in the heat of impeachment hearings, when she observed that the impeachment-charged House Judiciary Committee members were only important because La Quinn and the other media stars were covering them. Putting things another way, could it be that the new visibility and, quote, power of Congress comes from the fact that the legislative branch is the branch increasingly willing to voice what the national media once voiced? Exactly this argument comes from Edward Hunter, editor of the magazine Tactics. The press, he says, used to represent the interests and will of Congress and the people. But, quote, a decisive change has come about, especially since the expansion of the press by the inclusion of radio television. Congress now reflects the will and interest of the press, and the American people are supposed to think and act accordingly. Hunter says, and in my opinion his point is well taken, that the major media exercise a very effective form of censorship. To gain a place in the media sun, senators and representatives must stay out of the shade of liberal establishment disapproval. In Hunter's words, the press is now the third estate and Congress is the fourth estate. Our legislators and the administration first determine what the press will or will not use and set policy accordingly. If this sounds a bit extreme, remember how Lyndon Johnson chastised the media about raising up, quote, Teddy, Tunney, they're your creations, your products. Part of the power shift also flows from increasingly technical political decision-making and selection processes. Political writer Richard Reeves says, quote, the process is so complicated that it begs for interpretation, and we are the ones who make the interpretations. The biggest shift of power in the process has been from the political organizations to the press, and I think it's too big a role. Whatever the dynamics, a growing band of conservative theorists see the power of the media as having dwarfed, displaced, and even captured that of Congress. Thus, the national media, linchpin of the new class, are seen as the principal foe. Consider these words from National Review editor and Dartmouth professor Jeffrey Hart. Quote, the capacity of the media to dominate the terms of political debate gives it, at least for extended periods, a political leverage that may well be superior to that of a variegated and often ill-informed Congress. The key struggle on the frequent occasions when a centrist or conservative occupies the White House will be between Congress, between the president, and the media. And to Patrick Buchanan, the media are a bigger obstacle to conservatives than is the Democratic Party, so that only a powerful presidency can turn the tide. Presumably, it's unnecessary to add that I substantially agree with these analyses. However, at the risk of raising some eyebrows here, and enunciating a point of view, which is obviously something that people who are conservative would not like, it's very difficult for me to see any, quote, conservative politics succeeding unless it challenges the media. But I think it's also difficult to see any politics that does successfully challenge the media as being very, quote, conservative. In this post-industrial era of ours, the national media and knowledge industry are too central a part of the U.S. power structure. Any politics that challenges that position, that seeks to wield executive branch clout as in bygone crusades, whether Jackson's against the Bank of the United States or against the railroads, later against the trusts or Wall Street, will have to face up to what is a very neo-populist nature of the challenge. And any such challenge will profoundly divide those who wear the conservative label at the present time. At the same time, it's becoming very difficult for the national media and their new class allies to deny power elite status. They dislike my mediocrity thesis and its implications, yet American history suggests that major emerging socioeconomic elites have always generated strong political oppositions, and this one is no exception. Indeed, partly as a result of post-1960 negative reaction to the liberal politics of the new class, conservatism, and I put it in quotation marks, now finds itself strongest in areas like the South and West that were the stronghold of previous populist movements. Elite areas are the least conservative. The affluent east side of Manhattan voted solidly for George McGovern, and the Harvard Law School went 6-1 for the South Dakotan in a 1972 straw poll. So this is not the digression that it might appear. We're talking about power centers and coping with those power centers. To do this, one has to think in terms of classic issues, tactics, and constituencies. And the constituency here, perhaps the issue and challenge, is less traditionally conservative than it is populist. In my opinion, the arguments to which the major media are vulnerable are not piddling analyses of bias, but the age-old themes of privilege, concentrated power, secrecy, oligopoly, wealth, and arrogance towards the values and institutions of ordinary Americans. Raising these issues is not easy. At the first sound of tough criticism, many in the media pull the First Amendment out of their pockets and charge us with trying to extinguish freedom of the press. And anyone who's thrown off guard by this simply becomes an easier target. The best argument is the most direct. But the rise of major communications interests in the last 50 years has inflated the First Amendment into a protective device in much the same way that the 14th Amendment was perverted in the late 19th century to serve as a bulwark for emerging corporations by asserting the 14th Amendment's due process clause to block public economic regulation. Wait a minute, you'll say, doesn't the First Amendment and all it implies go back to the 1790s? To which I would say yes, but no. There was very little interpretation of the First Amendment until after World War I. Consider this historical capsule by the late Professor Alexander Bickel. The total career, robust or otherwise, of the First Amendment as part of the law of the Constitution encompasses little more than half a century. Of course, the First Amendment has been in the Constitution and has had pride of place in the Bill of Rights since 1791. So what we may think of its admonitory career is quite long, but its legal career and court decisions is a matter essentially of the past half century. Only in the years since the rise of the communications industry has the First Amendment become what it now so clearly is, a legal umbrella protecting that industry. Publishing stolen classified documents, listing the names of CIA agents who can then be assassinated, printing the names of rape victims, merchandising prejudicial pretrial publicity, showing pornography, or staging bottomless dances and nude ballets are or may be protected forms of communication. 50 years ago, they wouldn't have been, or had yet to become legal questions. The fact is, in the United States and almost everywhere else, that the law follows power, and the expansion of the First Amendment is no exception. It has followed the expanding power of the communications industry. Critical mass will come when the major media are perceived as enormously powerful commercial operations. Indeed, as among the newest and most highly developed form of U.S. economic activity, institutions that bear no socioeconomic relationship to the struggling backroom press of the 1790s. Gone are the days when anyone could start up the only existing communications vehicle, a newspaper, a periodical, with only minimum outlay. Today, it is still possible to start up a local newspaper or a specialized periodical, but who can start up a television network, a Newsweek, or a Washington Post? Nobody can. We're dealing with economic mass and concentration that would have been beyond the imagination of a Thomas Jefferson or James Madison. To hear their names invoked on behalf of, say, CBS's tawdry and specious. University of Toronto sociologist Louis Foyer has put it well. A handful of men, especially of the Columbia Broadcasting System, have an awesome grid with which to magnetize the opinions of many millions of people. The effects of their oligopoly with those of NBC and ABC have been of a kind that Adam Smith would have predicted. The free market for ideas continues to be steadily undermine the oligopolistic power of the networks. Perhaps increasing realization of this commercial magnitude and concentration will lead to more acceptance of the ideas of University of Chicago Professor Ronald Coase, who argues that normal treatment of government regulation of markets makes a unique distinction between the market for goods and services and the market for First Amendment-related commodities like speech and writing. Regulation of the goods market is applauded, regulation of the other is condemned. As Coase notes, the ideas market is the only one where laissez-faire is still respectable. Conservatives may applaud, but more careful analysis is likely to be a bit discouraging. Bear in mind that as manufacturing and industry had its laissez-faire period 100 years ago, its elite used that freedom to triumph over agriculture and aristocracy. Laissez-faire policies were a tool and expression of that triumph. 100 years later, with business on the run, there is no more chance of restoring laissez-faire in industry than there is of selling Manhattan back to the Indians. What's more, today's laissez-faire license for the media oligopolies and their new class viewpoints, as so effectively described by Irving Kristol, can generally be said to further threaten American manufacturing, agricultural, and natural resource producers. Indeed, laissez-faire for the media under the banner of the First Amendment represents a threat to non-knowledge industry private business and a force for the expansion of the knowledge industry-favored public sector of the economy. Just as laissez-faire for the 19th century industry and manufacturing was a force for the aggrandizement of the industrial segment of the economy at the expense of the agricultural sector. Now, to be sure, the emergence of the knowledge sector is a force that won't be denied. No way to turn it back. But it seems just as certain historically that more and more regulation will be imposed. Professor Coase suggests that although intellectuals, quote, exalt the market for ideas and deprecate the market for goods, the market for ideas is equally commercial, a place where the intellectual does his trading, and perhaps equally worthy of regulation in the public interest. As the media gain importance, I think this will happen. I'm sure Coase would say he'd prefer deregulation of all of it, but my suspicion is it'll go the other way. And wouldn't it be a fair turnabout if media products advocating busing, forgiveness for criminals, and the like could be removed from circulation by an intellectual product safety commission? So if, as I have argued, the media have emerged as a massive national power center, and if the answer is, as I believe it to be, active and innovative regulation, the last question is, what kind of active and innovative regulation? In the case of the television networks, it seems high time to more fully assert public control of and authority over the airwaves. Increased competition from cable has by and large proven to be a pipe dream, although perhaps it's just beginning to catch on, but I wouldn't bank on it as changing the legal system for the next 5 or 10 years. So that retreating hope should no longer distract us from strong measures. If a reformer could work in a political vacuum, the following would seem desirable. Strengthening the fairness doctrine as it applies to broadcasting, applying tough antitrust measures to break the three networks into 8 or 9, and forcing all networks to divest themselves of their owned and operated stations in opinion-molding markets like New York, Washington, and Los Angeles. By what logic should Exxon divest retail outlets and not NBC? And number three, establishing a national commission like Ontario's much-applauded Royal Commission on Violence in the Communications Industry to A, consider the impact of television in promoting crime, violence, social disintegration, and alienation, and then B, propose necessary legislation and regulations. As for the print media, the leading cartels and concentrations deserve careful attention. We should begin by thinking of companies and marketplaces and narrowing the expanded industry-wide First Amendment protections of the last 40 or 50 years. For example, the Washington Post has a dominant or substantial share of the market in Washington, D.C. on four levels: newspaper, news weekly, television, and AM/FM radio. And this is a market that differs from others in the country in that it serves as a national news dissemination center. Concentration in this market or in New York should be treated differently vis-a-vis a national information product and its dissemination than a similar concentration in Boise, Idaho. New antitrust legislation ought to differentiate types of media products, dissemination, and types of markets. Then there's another aspect to considering media conglomerates as commercial entities rather than as sacred First Amendment cows. Should an editorial or other favorable media accolade be considered as a corporate contribution? Take the example of two corporations in the drug business. One also owns a newspaper, one doesn't. The one without a newspaper may not be able to use corporate funds to run advertisements in support of industry's political goals. Shareholder suits are becoming more and more powerful. But the one with a newspaper can A, run all the editorials at once in support of drug industry political goals, B, endorse any candidate at once without giving space to an opponent, and C, run all the editorials or advertisements at once in support of the First Amendment and any other items of political and commercial importance to the media industry. In the future, I expect this paradox to become clear, with more attention being paid to the public or shareholder interest in restraining the self-serving acts of media as well as other corporations. For example, in Ohio, the Willoughby News Herald has been threatened with legal action by a mayoral candidate concerned about the newspaper endorsing his opponent. Candidate Christopher Aquila charged that the News Herald would be making an illegal corporate contribution. He says the editorial is something that has value. Contributions by a corporation of something of value are prohibited under Ohio law, and therefore he raises the question. Ohio Assistant Secretary of State James Marsh said this was a first, that newspaper space and endorsements were always deemed covered by the First Amendment. But as you begin to look at the differences between corporations and corporate privileges, the question is this fair, and how long will it go on being the vital distinction? Should this one powerful industry be allowed privileges other industries do not have? The debate is likely to grow. At this point, it may be appropriate to discuss that other great protest cry of the major media, quote, the public's right to know. Whenever a media corporation is seeking a privilege, like the right to boost its sales and peer group reputation by printing stolen classified information or other secrets, we hear about, quote, the public's right to know. What they are really doing is not for themselves, but for the people, you understand. However, in the privacy of court or legislative deliberations, there is absolutely none of that. The major media, when other privileges are involved, dismiss the rights of the public. Consider this very candid colloquy in an American Enterprise Institute symposium, and the statement comes from Floyd Abrams, a lawyer who frequently represents NBC and the New York Times. He was asked by the moderator, "Do you think, Mr. Abrams, that there is a right to know on the part of the public?" "Mr. Abrams, let me say that's a phrase that troubles me. Because if there is a right to know, then I suppose the public has a right to compel the press to print things, or the judiciary may have a right, or someone may have a right to decide what it is that the public should know." And I would say exactly. I would argue the major media have become so important that they exercise some quasi-public functions in which the public clearly has a regulatory interest. This could prove to be a critical tool and approach. Using the 14th Amendment, which prohibits states from denying anyone equal protection or due process, courts have held that this prohibition on state action can be extended to private corporations. In the case of Metropolitan Edison, Avco, and Gulf Shipbuilding, several examples, where the corporations are working for government or performing a public function. In this connection, bear in mind that 30-odd years ago, the then whites-only primary of the Democratic Party in the South were deemed to be private affairs beyond the reach of federal law. But in 1944, the U.S. Supreme Court found that the Texas Democratic primary was, in essence, serving so critical a political function that it amounted to government action, and the 15th Amendment regulatory jurisdiction was thus established. If The whites-only Democratic primary of Texas in 1944 represented so much of the political process that it could no longer be called private. How long will it be until the major media fall afoul of a kindred standard? Richard Reeves, Edward Hunter, Jeffrey Hart, Pat Buchanan, and others have all bluntly described the relentless flow of political and quasi-governmental power into these private hands. Even New York Times television reporter Les Brown, urging greater newspaper coverage of television, has characterized the networks as a government of leisure, because the average American family spends 6 or 7 hours in front of a television set each day. Now, I recognize that most of the remedies or suggestions or gadfly thoughts or other nuances that I proposed vis-a-vis the media raise what to many conservatives would be a specter of the type of regulatory extension and government power they have opposed in other sectors. And I think that's the case. I think that's an example of the great dichotomy that exists between conservatism functioning when it no longer has an elite in control of the country, but so many people trying to pretend that they still are the elite and cherishing the establishment and being afraid of the effective political mechanisms that can bring things to change. And perhaps the answer is that conservatism simply can't adjust, and as an ideology it will be dedicated to maintaining the precepts of the 1870s and the 1970s and progressively losing power accordingly. That may indeed be the case, and conservatism may figure its correct function is to deny those changes, and that may indeed be the case, but I think they have to be considered. Because unless they are faced up to, I think the flow of power is just unreversible. The national media are a major national power center, one of the greatest, and they will get bigger and bigger and bigger without effective countermeasures. And the politics of the next few decades will be in no small measure determined by what people like, the people in this room are courageous enough to do about it. Thank you.